Well, welcome everybody. This is day two of Listening Room. Today, I picked four short pieces for us to listen to that are all on the theme, that all I think have strong characters in them. So what do we know about the idea of what a character is in a story? This is, again, I'm just cribbing from Aristotle here, so this is not me again. In most stories, there are what kinds of people?
Good and bad.
Good and bad, right. And so we usually use the term like the protagonist and the antagonist for that. So there's the person, the protagonist, the person trying to do the thing that needs to be done or what he wants to do or she wants to do, and then there's the person trying to thwart them. But I also think that it's important to not necessarily think of them as good and bad, because sometimes the main character is not necessarily a good guy, but trying to do something, and then these other forces, either people or circumstances, that are trying to thwart them. In the pieces I picked out for today, there isn't quite... I don't think there's a real sense in most of the pieces who the good guy is and who the bad guy is. Maybe one of them. But I think it's much more complicated, and I think the way that the characters relate to each other is much more interesting when they are not either all good or all bad, or in some cases when they're just, it's people like sort of striving against circumstances. So I want to play the first piece for you, and then I have four pieces today. Each piece is 4 to 5 minutes long, and then we'll talk for about 5 minutes after, maybe 5 or 10 minutes after each one, and then go to supper.
Anyway, all this week on Morning Edition, we've been looking at the growing number of Americans who do not identify with any religion. The series is called Losing Our Religion, and it's time now to meet a couple for whom this subject is extremely personal. One partner has faith, and the other does not. Dina Pritchett reports.
Maria Pyre and Mike Bixby are one of those couples that just seem made for each other. They hold hands when they sit and talk. They're happy to spend the morning cooking brunch with their kids and stepkids in their southern Washington home. Mike and Maria have actually known each other since they were young, but only got married a few years ago, and it just hadn't been the right time until it was.
Gosh, she faced with me and asked if I remembered her, and then it just went from there.
But there's one big issue where they do not see eye to eye. Maria is Lutheran. Her father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all pastors. She's an assisting minister. And Mike is an atheist.
I do not believe that there is any sort of a higher power. I've made several attempts to go back and have faith, and it just doesn't work. It's not an open question for me anymore.
I would really like it if he could feel God's love the way I do. And it's one of those very few places where I feel like I can say, I hear you, I understand what you're saying, I love you, and I think that there may be more to it.
They do find ways to come together. Mike even goes along to church every now and then.
I heard a lot from Maria, you're very spiritual in this way, and you're very spiritual in that way, and a couple days ago, I kind of joked with her that that is a very secular humanist attitude. That shows a lot of growth, a lot of not faith or whatever.
Mike and Maria may disagree about faith, but they share common values, even in their vocations. She's an oncology nurse, and he teaches fourth grade.
Mike works with kids that come from really hard places, and I work with people that are dying of cancer and living with cancer, and for me to do that as a Christian person, for Mike to do that as an atheist, wouldn't look a whole lot different if either one of us were the other.
Maria's faith plays a role in making her the person that I love, and I'm good with that. I think we're both the people we are because of her faith, because of my lack of faith, and I don't want to change that.
In the past, couples like this often would make a change. Whichever person had the stronger conviction would set the terms. But these days, people are redrawing the lines.
These families are doing something different, and they're making their own choices.
That's Erica Saman. She teaches religion at Georgetown University and studies interfaith relationships. And she sees couples find common ground on love, ethics, even spirituality, while maintaining very different religious identities.
What it's doing is it's mixing up, confusing, and blurring these ideas of religion and community and affiliation and ritual and faith.
Seaman says that couples who do it successfully use the tools you might expect.
They listen and they talk and they try and understand one another. A number of them mention humor. You could probably take that list of advice that they would give and use it for any situation, whether it's religion or just raising children or getting along in the world.
Because Mike and Maria got together just a few years ago, they didn't have to hammer out a compromise on the kids. Hers are being raised Lutheran, his don't go to church. But these tools, communication, humor, compassion, help them work through their differences on other aspects of faith. And it's work they're grateful for.
I mean, it's not a what should we have for dinner kind of question, you know, it's a this matters. Dinner matters too, often a lot, but we don't fight about dinner. And we don't fight about this. It has very much helped me clarify what's true for me.
If I was a different type of non-believer and Maria was a different type of believer, then that would be a very different question.
I can love you and think you're wrong, and you can love me and think I'm wrong. So I appreciate this opportunity to grapple with it, and I appreciate you for being the one I get to grapple with it. But...
And grappling together for Mike Bixby and Maria Pyre looks a lot like love. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup.
So, I'm sometimes accused of working out my own issues on the radio. All of my stories are my issues on the radio. So what did you think about these characters? The reason that I didn't want to go down the road of being bad is that I think that they're just really interesting characters, and no one's the bad guy. And no, actually, no one's the good guy either.
Is it really as easy as it sounds? I mean, did you pick up anything else? I mean, it sounds like it's just fine for both of them.
Well, for them, I think it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't interview them. The reporter, Dina yeah. did. But there are some moments in there that I really like, and this is in the category of the small shit counts. There's this exhale that he gives very early on, where she asks him a question, and you hear him go, as if, like, I have to explain this again, or I'm always being asked this. And it's I love that sigh, and that's my favorite part of this piece, is that
I understand that, because Jeff is Lutheran and I am atheist. Mm-hmm. So I totally... know where they're coming from, and I mean, we don't really. I mean, he knows there's no convincing me, and I really know there's no convincing him either. So, and we kind of say we're at a stalemate with it, but I kind of understand the sigh because it's, you know, it's old news, but
right.
You know, what do you do about it? I mean, it's different here because I have to go to church. You know? It's not, oh, I can go to church, or, you know. So there's no, definitely the added level, but if I had the option, no. I would sometimes, just because it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's social power, but it's not, but you know what I mean.
One of the things I like about this piece is that each of the two main people in the story is a character, but then their marriage is also this sort of third character. Which I think about marriage a lot because I edit a lot of coverage of the topic of marriage at NPR. But I feel like this piece in particular, like, it actually talks about, like, what is the character of a good marriage? And a lot of what they're talking about is, you know, learning to disagree with each other, learning to be perfectly happy with that sort of that tension all the time. It's not, it's going to work out in the end or someone's going to win. It's, we can live with that tension. And I think that this sort of foreshadows what we're going to talk about Thursday with conflict and tension in stories, because I think that sometimes we want that to be resolved, but I think that some of the best stories, some of the best radio pieces, it isn't resolved. It's just, you have to sit with it and live with the constant tension.
When pieces like this play, do you ever get people like, well, what did the kids say? Like, why didn't you interview the kids?
Yeah, we interviewed the kids. They just weren't particularly articulate. I mean, they were teenagers. And
or
they were
interesting
kind of,
or something.
Yeah, I mean, they're like, it's fine. We go to church. We like going to church. And the other kids were like, well, we've never gone to church, we don't really talk about it, it doesn't matter to us. And so if they had something to say, we would have put it in. And we interviewed them. We actually also interviewed their pastor, who was awful. I mean, her pastor, who was awful. I mean, just like completely inarticulate. Yeah, I was kind of embarrassed by her. I thought we should not put her in this piece. But, I mean, if she had something interesting to say, but it was just sort of like, well, you know, I don't really think about the spouses who don't show up. You know, it's like, that's kind of a weird thing for a pastor to say. Mm-hmm. But.
Now, when you're editing these, do you already know I have to fill a 4 to 5 minute slot? Or is it sort of like, depending on what comes up?
Yeah, I usually have a ballpark figure in mind. Uh-huh. Like, I knew this piece. I mean, this is a pretty tightly edited piece. most of our stories tend to run between 3.5 and 5.5 minutes. Mm-hmm. This piece was 4.5, although I think there's a lot in it at 4.5. You know, I probably said to the reporter somewhere between 4 and 5. And that helps her know how much tape to gather. Like, you don't want to gather 20 hours of tape if your piece is 4 to 5 minutes long. You might gather 2 or 3 hours of tape. And that tends to be the, you know, I think with this, we probably spent 2 or 3 hours with them over the course of a couple of days. It's actually a beautiful photo slideshow. We sent a photographer out to, because this was part of a 5 or 6 part series about, well, for the, as Steve says at the top of the piece, losing our religion, because this Pew study came up. It's about, was it 20% of people in the United States identified as no religious affiliation. So that was, this was our part of our exploration on that. We talked to young people about why they weren't religious and so forth.
My favorite part of it was when he said that her religion makes her part of who she is, and that's what I like about her. So it, like, it highlights both of good qualities of both of their characters, even though they're different.
Mm-hmm.
That's my favorite part of it, I think.
Yeah. I just think this is, I love this. I think this is the story of a happy marriage. Because so often you hear stories of unhappy marriages on the radio. Well, I want to play another piece for you that has a strong main character, and I want you to think about who the antagonist is in this story. Because I think it's pretty complicated. I mean, there's another side, but I don't think that side is necessarily the antagonist. Because, well, I'll just play it for you and let you think about it.
Nelson Canuck is suing the state of Alaska. Canuck is an 18-year-old Yupik Eskimo. His house stands on melting tundra, and he says the state must do more about climate change. Here's Ed Runko of member station KCAW.
Nelson Canuck dashes across the gymnasium at Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka. He's enrolled in EMT class, and today is his first CPR test.
Starting compressions. 1, 2, 3, 4.
He delivers chest compressions to a plastic mannequin while his partner runs to grab the emergency defibrillator on the gym wall. Nelson and his partner work furiously to save the mannequin, but outside of class, and 1,000 miles away from this state-run boarding school, the high school senior hopes to save something much bigger and much more real, his home.
The river that runs in front of my house is called the Pugakshet River, and it means the middle one in the Yupik language.
Nelson is from a Yupik Eskimo village called Kipnuk. There are no roads in or out, so the river is the village's main highway. It's 7 hours by motorboat to the nearest town, and now that the permafrost isn't so perma, something is happening to Nelson's yard.
It's disappearing.
When the river ice moves out in the spring, it carves away at the bank. Last spring, the Canucks lost 8 feet from their yard.
And then as the summer progressed, we lost another 5 feet.
How much is left before it gets to your house?
Last fall before I left, there was about 40 feet or so. But when springtime comes, there's definitely going to be a couple more feet that will be lost.
This is how his family has lived for generations. On a river delta in western Alaska, where the land provides what the local store cannot.
We actually go out into the tundra and we harvest salmon berries. And we actually go out into the river and we fish for salmon. And then we go out to the ocean in the springtime, and that's how we get the seal meat that we need to help us survive in wintertime.
Nelson Canuck is one of 6 young Alaskans suing the state with help from the organization Our Children's Trust. The Oregon-based nonprofit filed lawsuits on behalf of young plaintiffs against 9 states and the federal government. The lawsuits ask the states to consider the atmosphere a public trust and to exercise their duty to protect it. Part of the argument is that if the state of Alaska can manage other natural resources under its control, for example by issuing hunting or fishing licenses, it should also be able to manage what's released into the atmosphere. Seth Bosang, a lawyer for the state of Alaska, says he understands part of the argument.
But the state has almost no control over the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere because that is determined by global emissions of greenhouse gases.
Bosang says the issue of whether the state should regulate the atmosphere doesn't belong in the courts at all.
We say that it is more consistent with democratic principles for Alaska's elected representatives to be making policy in this area. We think the legislature and the governor should be making policy, not a single Superior Court judge.
But Nelson Canuck says the political process might be too slow, especially as he watches the river move closer to swallowing his home.
It's not a few years anymore. It could be within the next year.
A state court judge in Anchorage dismissed Nelson's case, and he's appealing that decision. He says he understands some people might view an eroding riverbank as a consequence of living in a remote wilderness, but he doesn't see it that way.
It's not different from your home, because that is where we live, and it's a part of who we are. And it's the same with you.
What happens to Nelson's home depends on river ice and permafrost, but what happens to Nelson's case is up to the Alaska Supreme Court. It's expected to hear an appeal sometime this year. For NPR News, I'm Ed Ronco in Sitka, Alaska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
So I'm never quite clear in this piece who the antagonist is. It's very clear that Nelson is the protagonist of this piece. What do you think?
I mean, I feel like you can make an argument for a couple of different, just kind of multi-layered. On the one hand, you know, he has the state who he's
right.
suing.
And that's the sort of apparent
right.
opposition.
Right. The sense I get is that that's kind of the only entity he has available to take this out. So, you know, on another level, you could say it's the river. The river is... the environment is moving closer, taking away some. And then there's kind of the unnamed other forces that are totally out of his control.
Right, when Ed and I were talking about this piece, we kept talking about the antagonist being like, all of us.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's
what I was
saying,
yeah, it's
everyone.
Yeah. And all of our grandparents who have already, you know, gone before us.
Right.
It's actually people we can't get at anymore.
Right, right.
Near as I can tell.
Which makes the losses, like, you know, I want, so one of the main things that you hope for with the protagonist is that you will empathize with that character. And I completely empathize with him. At the same time, there isn't, like, I don't think his legal argument really holds that much water, because as the state does argue, like, we could regulate this, but it's just a small state that, I mean, a small, it doesn't actually, you know, exude that much fossil fuel or greenhouse gas, but like nothing could be done. You know, what is the state of Alaska going to do? Really, it's a global issue. So I empathize with him, but I also think he's up against forces that are way beyond a high school student or beyond many people's challenge or abilities to confront.
It seems to me that the weather, the warming, is the force that he's fighting against.
Mm-hmm.
And he's electing to try to use governmental pressure to get people to change or something. But regardless, the warming is going to continue happening for a long time. And he's probably going to lose his house.
Right.
I mean,
there's a great moment at the end where he's, you know, I think that it's so apparent in lots of places in Alaska. Alaska Public Radio about 10 years ago did this great piece about this church that actually the water, like their church was about to fall into, and so they had to like physically pick up and move this whole church. You know, there's this moment that he says near the end, which is like, this home is my home and you have a home too, or something like that. And this could be like, this is happening to my home. It's no different from your home. Because I think that we can often sort of imagine, as we point out in the piece, well, why would you live 7 hours away from the nearest city on a river? I mean, it sounds like an awful place to live, but it's where he's from, and you know, people get to be from somewhere, and people can get to want to go back to where they're from.
Well, it seems that if you have generations and generations that have been there, they ought to be able to stay.
Yeah.
That's what Louisiana said too.
Sorry?
That's what Louisiana said too, right?
After Katrina. Yeah.
Water's a universal salt, though. Enough time, enough pressure, it'll remove anything. So I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one thing that's interesting there is that, you know, I'm sure that there have been other forces that have had to cause people to move in those areas, too.
I think he's also saying, this is happening to me, and it's going to happen to you. It's not happening yet.
Yeah.
It's going to happen to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, my take was more that he didn't actually think it was realistic that he was going to save his own home, but that he wanted something to be done so that things would start changing for other places.
Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, I think that he's smart enough to know that this lawsuit probably not. I think this aired about a year ago. I think it was actually dismissed also by the state Supreme Court, so that it can't go any farther. But I think, you know, he wanted to draw attention to this topic, and sometimes people do things just for the sake of drawing attention to the topic.
At the beginning, it's talked about the lawyer that took the case or that contacted him to.
Pro
bono lawyer.
Yeah, the environmental group.
Right. Did you guys follow the other 10 cases that lawyer also?
We looked at those. This was the most articulate person. I mean, quite often what we do is, you know, we're not writing the 10,000 word magazine piece. We're writing the 4 minute story, and so you find like the most interesting character to tell the story through. We interviewed the people from, what's it called, the Our Children's Trust or something like that. We talked to the director of that organization or the chief counsel, and you know, we ended up just not putting him in the piece because Nelson was actually more articulate. But I mean, Nelson makes a good case through his personal experience, and then we let the reporter actually give some of the arguments that the person from the Our Children's Trust made. I mean, one of the tricky things in a radio piece is that you don't want too many people in a story because you'll lose track of them. Were you here yesterday? We played this about 15-minute long piece where there are so many people, it's a little hard to keep track of them. And I think that although there were many characters in that Katie Street piece that we heard yesterday, no one necessarily stands out. These are all stories today where there's one very clear main character. And you quite often do that by deciding what not to put in as well. You know, you may interview 10 people for a story and only put, this piece only has 2 people in it besides the reporter. So quite often we're deciding, well, this person, you could say this faster and better than this person does, so we won't put them in, or we want to make more room for developing Nelson as a character, so we're not going to put in the chief counsel from the environmental organization. I mean, any good reporter will talk to all of those people, but you don't necessarily get to hear all of those people on the radio.
One other level it's all of us kind of in this antagonistic role. Nelson said at one point, you know, where I'm from, people actually go out on the river and actually fish for salmon, and they actually go out and harvest berries because it's actually important to us. So it's kind of challenging, I think, a lot of our perceptions of how people live Nelson saying this is actually really what we do to us.
The line going into that piece of tape is Ed, the reporter, saying, where the river provides what the store can't. And isn't that interesting? Like normally you would think of like what the store provides what the river can't. But I mean they live so far away from everything that it's a dinky little store that's barely a convenience store. So when he said that line to me, I was like, that's an amazing line. Where the river provides for the store.
Yeah.
Thoughts about character in this piece? Okay, well, I want to play a piece for you now that I understand that Nadia Bolz-Weber has spent some time here, and so maybe some of you have interacted with her. I started editing a few more religion pieces this year, over the last year or so, and so the first piece about interfaith marriage is part of that project, and this is another one. I don't want to say too much about why I assigned this story, but let me just play it for you. I will let you know that the reporter in this piece was, she was like, I haven't gone to church since confirmation in the Episcopal Church, and she said, and I had some hippy-dippy pastor at the time, and so I don't know anything about religion. And I said, that's perfect. Like, that's the best reporter to go into a situation like this, because you'll be very open to what she's saying and learning about her and her congregation. So this piece aired on Morning Edition on Christmas Eve last year.
A tattooed, foul-mouthed pastor in Denver has been getting a lot of attention.
I fell in love with Lutheran liturgy and Lutheran theology, but I would go and visit Lutheran churches, and I'd look around, and no one looked like me.
That's Nadia Bolz-Weber talking to a crowd full of youth last year. Her new book is called Pastrix, The Cranky, Beautiful Faith of a Sinner and Saint. It recently hit the New York Times bestseller list. Bolz-Weber has struck a nerve with a lot of mainline Protestants whose churches are getting older and smaller. Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verley reports.
It's Sunday evening, and services are just getting underway at the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver.
By the grace of God in Christ Jesus, your sins are forgiven, and you are made free.
Close to 200 worshipers sit in circles of plastic chairs, ringing the simple altar table.
Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord.
The congregation here resembles the crowd at a downtown bookshop, hipsters and college professors, gay couples and Democratic grandmas. But even in such a diverse crowd, the congregation's pastor, with her short, loose hair and armloads of religious tattoos, stands out as she launches into a sermon about Jesus on the cross.
In our win-lose way of understanding things, it would have made a lot more sense for Jesus to have come and been a superhero, kicking ass and taking names, showing everyone how strong God is by winning at our game.
Pastor Nadia Bolz-Weber is a bit of a Lutheran rock star at the moment, although the term makes her cringe. What she and her church are trying to do is simple and radical: create an authentic Christian experience without all the pretension that often comes with church.
I think people's tolerance for is at an all-time low.
I met up with Bolz-Weber in the Denver coffee shop where she meets with parishioners. What people want, she says, is a spiritual community that's beautiful and transformative and maybe even transgressive. And that's not what you find in most churches, conservative or liberal.
We've been given social conventions, we've been given basically the Elks Club with Eucharist, or we've been given a place to gather on Sundays where basically what we hear is the same as the platform of the Democratic Party. I don't think that early Christians martyred themselves for either of these things.
Bolz-Weber's path to becoming an increasingly public theologian was rocky, to say the least. Early in adulthood, she drifted away from her parents' conservative Church of Christ and into a lost period of drugs and alcohol, only for God to find her again as she struggled to get sober. That checkered history is something she talks about openly, trying to help others feel comfortable with their own failings.
There was a young woman who, I took her confession, and it was for real. I mean, it was something really heavy. And she was super tense at the beginning, and then she relaxed, and we just went through the process, and we did the absolution and prayer. And then we were kind of laughing, and she goes, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you're my pastor, because I know you've done much worse than that. I offer.
Hear over and over again when members of House for All Sinners and Saints talk about their congregation is intentional. Every innovation they've made serves one big purpose: to welcome everyone. They offer communion to anyone, regardless of whether they've been baptized, and they open the liturgy to all who want to participate. That really struck Stephen Ludwig when he first attended a service after a decade away from the church.
Everyone that shows up has an opportunity to read scripture, serve communion, participate in the service, because what liturgy is supposed to be of the people. And this really brings it back to that.
At House, the work of the people goes far beyond the church walls. The congregation is deeply active in the community, from serving monthly meals at a shelter for homeless youth to an annual bake sale they call the Selling of Indulgences. Events like that draw attention, but the faith the congregation practices is, for lack of a better word, completely Orthodox Lutheran.
When I look at Nadia, I think Martin Luther would just be having his heyday. He would be saying, that's what I'm talking about.
That's Bishop Jim Gonia, the Rocky Mountain Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. He says Lutherans hold to three core principles, that God's love is unconditional, that God is most revealed in times of suffering, and the church itself is a place of paradox. That tension shows up in the congregation's name, House for All Sinners and Saints. It comes from Martin Luther's belief that everyone is simultaneously all sinner and all saint. Gonia says this congregation is revitalizing a church where worshipers too often seem moved more by habit and nostalgia than spirit.
We're not just a cultural church of potlucks and jello and whatever the Midwestern Lutherans the Garrison Keillor Lutherans.
House for All Sinners and Saints has piqued the curiosity of other congregations. Becky Runschler directs youth ministry at a church in Columbia, Missouri. On a recent vacation in Denver, she included a service at House on her itinerary. Afterward, she tried to explain Bowles Weber's appeal.
I think her return to that open concept of grace, that God really loves everyone and we should be loving everyone as God loves us, kind of shows that God is here for everyone, not just for the people who were white on Sundays to go to church.
As Bowles Weber's popularity has grown, so many people have started visiting that there often aren't enough chairs for the regulars. Longtime worshiper Stuart Sanks admits that having so many new people stopping in can be difficult.
Sometimes it feels like House is losing that idea of what made it different. But that's just something that we're trying to figure out and work through and, you know, make the best of stewarding the responsibility, I guess, that, you know, we can do.
For Bowles Weber, that responsibility is exciting, rethinking the way the church exists in the world today. She's more interested in her congregation having a dynamic, faithful relationship with God and getting hung up on the specifics of what they believe.
For a long time in Christianity, belief was the basis of belonging. And that's not the case for us. People in my church believe all kinds of things. You're going to have to trust me on that.
While no single common belief holds the congregation together, Bowles Weber says certain values are universal. To welcome all and to take that message of grace out into the world. For NPR News, I'm Megan Verlee in Denver.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
So what do you think?
Yes. I find it extremely offensive.
Why?
That church feels like they are the only Lutheran church with those kinds of beliefs. And there are many churches who support anybody coming into their door, who support anybody serving communion, who support all of those tenets that she said. And I find it offensive that it is assumed that only white people go to most churches.
The white people?
Yeah, she made a comment. Somebody made a comment.
Where white?
Oh, where white?
And I just find it offensive that that church feels like they are the only Lutheran church that has those kinds of problems. Because I attend a church that's exactly like that. We don't have a pastor who is dressed out in tattoos, but we have those exact qualities of a church. And I'm sure most people here would say the same thing about your church.
That's interesting. Her book is really a good read. And you'll probably get more of a flavor from the more in-depth conversation that she has. I don't think that she's... My take on it was that she wasn't saying that they're the only church that's like that, but by virtue of her own story, her fallenness, and the fact that she still feels loved by God, I think a lot of people find that inviting. It's almost like unmasking some of the sacred, and I don't even know how else that would be. But I really recommend your book, though. I mean, I think you'll get a different take on it.
And it could have been.
Did you get the sense that she was saying no other churches are like that?
Well, it could have just been the questions that were asked, mm-hmm. and the way they were asked. I mean, it could have all been formed around maybe the assumption that the reporter was making as they went into it. I mean, there's a lot of things that shaped that kind of an interview, but the way it was shaped to my ear, I found it offensive. I would have been mad and shut that off.
Really?
Is it in the editing some of this? I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that most churches are horrible, and the reporter and I probably agree on that. And that most churches are not anything like this. Now, there may be some that are. But
I think there's a lot more than...
There's a lot more than there used to be.
A lot more what?
He thinks there's a lot more than there used to be.
Like this.
Yeah,
I think that that's true.
Approachable.
Yeah, I think that's
true.
Well, I think they have to.
This sort of community,
right.
People who come to Holden tend to come from churches who are more like this.
Sure, I think that's very true. I try to think about who our audience is, and our audience tends to be... mostly secular humanists, I imagine. Although some people
mostly what?
Secular humanists in the NPR audience. Although
can you give a short definition of what that is?
Oh, not more like the guy in the first piece, atheists who are interested in sort of what makes interested in being good and talking about shared values, but not having any interest in religion
divine.
Or spirituality,
yeah.
Or anything like that. Sort of believe that human intellect and reason can fix what is wrong.
That's worked really well.
So I think the reporter may have come with this assumption, but it's probably one that reflects that of a lot of the listeners that you're talking about in a lot of society.
Is it maybe also too upset or to get people to react to the story?
The reason we had her swearing at the beginning was to get people to pay attention, because I think when we started with a foul-mouthed tattoo pastor, and the first two pieces of tape you hear from her have to be bleeped. That was to get people's attention, pay attention to this. I mean, I think though I would push back a bit, and I think that you're right, Ellen, that like people who come here are used to churches much more like hers than others, but I think that the vast, vast majority, I mean, I spent 10 years covering religion, and I went every Sunday to a church that wasn't mine, and I was so bored and depressed by the end of those 10 years. I thought, if this is what a religion in America is, it should shut itself down right now, because it was really depressing.
You went to 500 different churches?
No, I went, over 10 years, I usually spent at least 40 or 50 weeks a year just visiting churches. I reported in Chicago, but then nationally for a while. I just wanted to see what was going on. And it was incredibly
awful.
It was awful. Well, this was during a period when I wasn't going to church myself. Like, I had no congregation, and it was probably, it was sort of thought of myself as on an anthropological expedition into religious America.
So this part of the country is known as the nun zone.
Yep.
And so they're probably, the nun zone is when you fill out a form and it says religion.
No.
Oh.
Right.
Most people in this area put none.
Yeah.
So I suspect we do have a whole lot more secular people.
Yeah. That first piece that I played, we mentioned that their number is 20% nationally, but it's much higher in the Pacific Northwest. I think it might be edging up toward 40%.
So, where is this church?
This congregation is in Denver. Or I think it's either in Denver proper or suburb of Denver.
Okay, so I wasn't thinking of Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
Well, I think she's been here.
Uh-huh.
We have tapes of hers in the Auto Archive.
She was a comic. Her history is that she had been a comic, and so one of them is really funny. But anyway, one of the things that strikes you when you see her is that she looks different. She's strikingly like herself, like no one else.
and she might have a few tattoos, but she has more than a few. And then the fact that she's a pastor is sort of fascinating.
And she's like 6 feet tall.
She's, yeah, tall and slender. And she, but then when she's in her robes and she's doing her pastor act during church, fulfilling the role of the pastor in the service, you're struck again by the stereotyping that you did when you saw the tattoos and her hair or her demeanor or whatever. And she's a really nice person. And she's very pastorly, if I could say it like that. So, I mean, there are various ways that she can strike you when you meet her.
What was interesting to me about this piece is that I, you know, I sort of, she'd gotten a lot of press, and not just, you know, like in Lutheran circles, but she was on CNN and a few other places. And I didn't know what to think about her, and then I read her book, and I really didn't like her book because I didn't think she was that great a writer. And then I said to the reporter, like, let's go investigate this. And I ended up, by the, between the time that I signed this and the time that I finished it, I was really charmed by her, and I did not expect that. I'm very, very hard on pastors. Mm-hmm. I don't suffer fools gladly. Mm-hmm. And she ended up...
I put up with Mary Ellen all morning.
Come on, I'm listening. She and I already had that conversation about not suffering fools.
About all the fools.
But I mean, I thought I was just fascinated by the fact that I was charmed by her, and I am not charmed by very many people. So as that changed over the course, and she played, the reporter ended up playing like more of the interview for me than I heard. I don't, as the editor, generally like to listen to unedited tape because I want the reporter to make those decisions. At any given time, I have 25 pieces in the works, and I can't sit through raw tape with people. Mm-hmm. But I was surprised at how much I ended up being charmed by her. That said, I did not, when I was in Denver recently, go to visit a congregation.
Well, in terms of character, I kept thinking, is she a diva or is she not a diva? And then are people going to try to replicate her charismatic energy in some sort of inauthentic way to get more people to be in their congregation? So in terms of her character, I kept thinking, how does she feel about herself as this leader? And
I don't think she thinks of herself as a diva, but I think
no, but I think her bishop
right.
does,
yeah.
And I think a lot of people within the Lutheran Church.
And it was hard, like, you know, with the questions to know really what she felt, because her responses were pretty down to earth.
I mean, one of my favorite responses is the part where she talks about, like, she's doing this thing that, like, she's taking a private confession, which, like, not many pastors do that, first of all. And then, you know, talking about how, you know, sort of in this moment that sort of reveals herself, it's like, I have done much worse than this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, on your topic of character, and I mean, for me, hearing this is really hard, in a sense, because, I'm at Holden, in a place that probably generally was really receptive, somebody like 90 Volts or whatever. I've read her book, so it's kind of hard to filter through those things. But if I was just listening to this for the first time, I think, you know, what character does is gives nuance to kind of a state of understanding of things. And here it is on Christmas Eve, we're kind of in the height of our churchy, everybody together feeling. And we have somebody who doesn't really fit in and stands out in certain ways. So I think that would be, I think that's part of it too, that timing is worked well for that in some sense.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, what was interesting to me is that there are so many moments in this piece when the reporter ended up saying things that I was like, where did you get that phrase, God found her? Because that sounds like, she's like, well, that's how Nadia said it, so I want to say it that way rather than she found him. I was like, oh, that's a great line. You should definitely keep that line in. I also think, and not that I don't edit religion pieces to make people think anything in particular religiously, but I like the idea that there may have never been a person before listening to Morning Edition who heard something like, mm-hmm. you know, bring all your doubts and everything to this congregation too. Because I think that, I mean, as she says, her last piece of tape is, you know, Like, there isn't a checklist of things you have to believe to show up here. And I think that that's really, especially on Christmas Eve, when people might be thinking about going out. I did not think about, like, trying to convince people to go to church by this piece. I was more interested in sort of the phenomenon of pastors.
What was your response to that character? I mean, because she's got such a strong character.
What was
the response of that piece?
I think there were a lot of really angry, very conservative people of faith who, you know, said that she was embarrassing to Christianity. I mean, that's actually the that was actually most people who wrote in, and there was like you know, thousands of people. We have 27 million listeners, so thousands of people write in for any story, and people were like deeply offended by her as, you know, how can you say she's Christian? How can you say she's a pastor? This is wrong. Actually, we get anytime we have female clergy on the radio, this huge number of anti-female clergy people write into us. It's kind of shocking, like. It's not even like an open question in most.
Make me sad.
I know. If you saw our mail, you'd be sad. We're kind of out of time, but I want to play one more piece for you, if you don't mind. It's 5 minutes long, but it's about a series I did for earlier this summer on long-term caregiving. And I think it's a good... there are basically three characters in this story, and I'm fascinated by all of them.
This weekend, NPR is bringing you stories about families who provide long-term care for relatives. Here's a surprising number. An estimated 17 million people in the United States are taking care of children with special needs. That could be anyone from a kid with asthma to one with cerebral palsy. Depending on the severity of the diagnosis, the work can be grueling. And now that kids are living longer, it's raising questions for their caregivers about how to plan for the future. Katie Orr with Capital Public Radio in Sacramento reports.
Judy and James Lee gently rouse their son Justin after a relatively good night of sleep.
You're awake. Uh-huh. Oh, you're awake. You have a good sleep. Oh, you slept good last night. I'm so glad you didn't have any seizures.
A good night's sleep is rare in the Lee house. Justin, who was born missing parts of his brain, also has a seizure disorder, which has gotten worse lately. He's often silent during his seizures, which means he has to sleep with his parents so they can tell when he needs help. Judy says caring for Justin is a lot like taking care of a newborn.
You're in that kind of survival mode, those first few minutes where your baby's schedule is your schedule. And, you know, you sleep when they sleep and you eat when they eat. And all your focus and attention is on them.
Except Justin is not a baby. He just turned 16 and he weighs 100 pounds. He can't talk, he can't walk, and he'll always require 100% care. Judy's days largely consist of making sure Justin gets that care. He receives music therapy, occupational therapy, and tutoring. Today, it's physical therapy.
Okay, bend it. Okay, you can. There you go.
While some may question what effect all the therapy may have, James and Judy believe it's about giving Justin the best life they possibly can.
While physically, we know he has so many restrictions, my hope is that cognitively he's able to express what he knows, express his needs and his wants, especially as we get older and other people will be naturally having to care for him.
And Judy and her husband James know that day is coming. As far as they know, Justin has a normal lifespan, but they're both in their 50s and have no other children. James says it's something he thinks about often.
So there's going to come a time when we're going to need to care for ourselves, and so there's going to be three of us in here all needing some sort of care. I don't know what's going to happen then. I really don't know.
Juno Duenas is the Executive Director of Support for Families of Children with Disabilities.
One technique we've used here is to bring the community together that knows that youth and have a discussion about, so what are we going to do in the future?
Duenas says as parents age, it's important to get a support system in place for the child.
And to help that family as bring the friends and maybe care providers of that youth or other people in the community that might know that youth to talk about what are the options and how each of those people might be able to help.
The faith community is a major source of support for James and Judy Lee. Every Sunday, the family attends Mass at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Sacramento. James welcomes people's empathy, but he rejects their pity. He recalled a man at a support group once asking him if he hated God because of Justin's disability.
I said, no, I'm actually thankful that he chose us to take care of Justin.
It was faith that helped Judy get through her initial grief and accept Justin's diagnosis.
Through prayer, I've been given just the grace and the strength to meet those challenges and to see the positive, because there are so many positives. I mean, Justin's a great kid. He's sweet. He's loving. And I can't help but be happy being his mom.
The Lees also know they're fortunate compared to other families in their situation. James and Judy have flexible work schedules, enough money to buy Justin the ramps and wheelchairs he needs, and each other to lean on. And they hope that will be enough to care for their son for many years to come. For NPR News, I'm Katie Orr in Sacramento.
This was part of a three-part series that I brought in on the 4th of July weekend that looked at basically long-term caregiving for people in situations where they weren't going to get better. And I'm fascinated by children who aren't going to get better.
I have two friends. Well, one of them was my cousin, and the other one was a friend. My cousin's son was born with pyloric stenosis, which is a narrowing of the pyloric valve, that's the outlet of your stomach, and it was misdiagnosed until he was 2 years old, and he was nearly starved to death. They kept telling her that it was a bad immune system, blah, 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 blah. As a result of that, he had projectile vomiting for the first 2.5 years of his life. And the projectile vomiting caused extensive damage to his hearing. So the kid was born with Down syndrome, pyloric stenosis, and then he ended up profoundly deaf because of the secondary stuff. And he also is hyperactive, so he has very little verbal skills. And his name's Riley. He's 16 now. He's also about 100 pounds, and he's a constant motion thing. But he's the youngest of their kids, and they're looking at whether they can find a way to buy a second home so they can start a group home, so that there'll be something for him in the future. And that's really a hard thing, just because he has full range of motion and full range of emotion, and he's just hit puberty, so it's been a real trial. The other friend of mine, they moved to Texas. They were in Bellingham, but they moved to Texas because the support for deaf-blind people is much better there. There's a particular school, and it's paid for by taxes. And their daughter was born with a seizure disorder, much like that young man. And we call her Pookie, her name is Natasha. She also is, she's 20 now. She'll never be out of diapers. She has seizures. She has a puck in her chest that stimulates the vagus nerve. And I mean, they've gone to, but at the same time, to say that you're not thankful for her, she's an amazing child.
That's a great moment at the end when the mother says that.
No, if you knew these people, in fact, I'm going to go out to see them in about a week and a half. I just, because they're coming to Bellingham, and I can't wait.
The two pieces of tape that I like the most in this story is the father saying that he doesn't want to be pitied.
Yeah.
He's happy that people empathize with him, but he doesn't want to be pitied. And then the other piece of tape, the mother going, Justin's a good kid. He's funny. He's a sense of humor.
I love when the dad says, I'm thankful he was born to us.
Yes. I went back and forth on that because I was very specific. Like, they very much reject the, like, that horrible, like, God doesn't give you anything more than you can handle crap theology. But I like that particular piece of tape because, of, like, well, they, you know, as we point out toward the end, you know, they actually have a fair bit of money and they can afford to. So, you know, glad that we're the ones who can care.
I also kind of heard that as, like, this guy who's like, don't you hate God? And he's like, well, comparing to this, like, that guy's reaction to having a son that had.
Right,
so he
yeah.
was like, well, I'm glad we're raising him.
Yeah, rather than you.
That's how I thought.
Yeah,
okay.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a
what I'm mostly thankful is that he wasn't born to you.
Right. Right. I hadn't thought of it, but I bet that might very well be what he was thinking. Yeah, I want to tell you a little story about this, and then I'll go to lunch and dinner. We sent a photographer out to photograph this family, and we have this amazing picture of the father carrying the son, almost like a baby, but he's 100 pounds, and he's wearing a diaper. And this was like on the front page of our website. It got tens of thousands of hits. And most of the people were very angry that we had put that picture because it was too painful to look at. And then there was a whole group of people who said, you know, it was really exploiting him, like Justin didn't have the ability to say it was okay to take that picture. Well, in all situations, we wouldn't take a picture of a child and put it on the radio without the parents' permission. So the parents had given permission, but I was really shocked at the sort of the vitriol, because I think this is a wonderful story of like these amazing parents who have extraordinary circumstances that they're living through. But I also, you know, I do, part of my job is to like tell the stories of people so that you can understand stories unlike your own and learn to empathize with them and have eventually grow in compassion for them. But I also understand that part of that is exploiting them. Like, I'm telling their story, they chose to speak with us, we didn't force them or anything. And I think that a lot of people do, you know, sit down for interviews with us because they think that hearing other people hearing their story will help other people, if not at least try to understand, but or just know that there are other people like them in the world, like also struggling with a very similar issue. But then I also got to thinking, you know, it is a very intimate picture of Justin being carried by his father, and I think it's a beautiful picture. But, you know, is it somewhat exploitative? Well, yeah, and what I do is tell people stories. And that in some way, and, you know, taking their stories. I'm not doing it for profit, that's for sure, since I work for not for profit. But it got me to thinking a lot about, you know, the ethics around telling other people's stories.
It sounds to me like they're enough in touch with him to know if he would like that to happen or not.
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, the reporter spent, this is actually part of a much longer documentary that the reporter did for her local station on three different families, all of whom were caring for people in long-term care situations. And so, you know, she spent months with them. The final documentary is about 20 minutes long, so this is like an excerpt of that. So she had a really good sense that, you know, the parents know the child really well.
That was an interesting thing when you think about in the three stories we've heard tonight, how we've gotten to know kind of the main character, or the main, the protagonist in a sense. And in some ways, I mean, you can make the argument that Justin really isn't the protagonist in the story, it's these two parents, but he's kind of the focal point.
Yeah.
And we get to know him in some ways through, he's totally silent, and we don't really...
And doesn't really talk.
Doesn't really talk, and there's not really any connection with him, but it's through the people around him. And we kind of piece together this picture of what this young man's like. In comparison with the other stories, where we talked with Nelson. And
right, you hear from all of the other main characters.
Right.
Well, thank you again for coming tonight. We don't have anything tomorrow. And then on Thursday, we're going to do tension or conflict.